against open warfare with the whites, invading their hunting grounds south of the river. These whites weren't traders, who'd come among them for years, beginning with the French. Nor were they missionaries, who'd settled among the Delawares and now had whole villages of Christian converts. These men came to blaze the trees and cut them down, to put up cabins and corn, kill the game and fill the land with cattle and hogs, an endless stream of settlers spilling down the Ohio like floodwaters. Fiery young warriors, seeing their hunting grounds taken, couldn't always be controlled by elders who urged peace. Even the Shawnee war chief, Pukashinwa, who'd spent the last months in talks with the Indian agents at Fort Pitt, was ready to raise the war club in the face of Virginia Governor Dunmore's inability to stem the tide of illegal settlement down the Ohio. 3 days ago, Jeremiah had left the frustrated Pukashinwa and his Shawnee delegation in Pittsburgh and descended the Ohio with Kune's husband, the white trader John Gibson, hoping to discover whether the alarming rumors being spread about Indian attacks had basis in fact. Assured by a band of Shawnees met on the river that their warriors hadn't been out killing whites, Gibson felt sure the rumors were false. Major Conley was attempting to excite alarm, likely to further some land-grabbing scheme of Governor Dunmore's to snatch up the Ohio Territory before Pennsylvania could claim it. Gibson had traded canoes for pack horses and continued overland toward the Shawnee towns on the Scioto River to do his trading. Less sanguine about the rumors, Jeremiah had turned his canoe for Yellow Creek. Surely Logan's warriors weren't raiding across the river. He was known widely as a friend to the white man, but perhaps he'd know if others were. Logan had been away at a hunting camp when Jeremiah arrived, but what caused a true disquiet was learning Logan's family had crossed to Baker's Post, lured by the invitation of some white men promising whiskey. Distant shots had echoed across the river almost before the news was shared. Jeremiah had gone over by canoe with a warrior sent to investigate, only to be repelled by more gunfire. Runners had been sent to Logan's hunting camp to bring him in. That morning they'd finally made it ashore, to find the dead lying scalped and mutilated. The killers long fled. Jeremiah sought for words to fill a mouth gone dusty. He wanted to comfort Logan, caution him not to rush to blame, say something to turn aside what could easily follow this atrocity, a full-scale border war. To mind rose memory of Kune's lifeless face, beaten almost beyond recognition, and he thought it would take a rare man, faced with such violation, to turn aside from vengeance. Maybe it was Cressop, maybe not. Surely the Indian agents at Pittsburgh will. Jeremiah fell silent when Logan's gaze lifted, knowing nothing he could say would matter. What he'd seen this day would haunt Jeremiah for his next 30 years, should he live so long. So would what he read in the tormented eyes turned on him now. Where once had leapt the flame of friendship for Jeremiah's race, there blazed a hatred mere words could never douse. Alarm crawled over Jeremiah's scalp. Not for himself. In Logan's eyes, he was no longer a white man. His alarm was for every settler fool enough to linger west of the mountains after today. Logan seemed to read his thoughts. Lifting his shoulders until he stood lance straight, fingers curving round the tomahawk thrust through his sash, the Mingo bound Jeremiah with that burning gaze. "For every life here taken from me," he said through lips set tight with rage, "by my hand, 10 whites will die."